When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Too Much Information, the show that brings you the secret histories and little-known fascinating facts and figures behind your favorite movies, music, TV shows, and more. We are your two Petes of pedantry. I'm Alex Heigl.
Petunias of pedantry. And I'm Jordan Runtalk.
And today, Jordan, we are talking about one of the odd ducks of Nickelodeon's 1990s heyday. Although, weren't they all?
They all, yeah.
In a beautiful way.
We'll talk more about that. What a great era, though.
The exceedingly strange sitcom that baffled parents and children alike. That's right. We're talking about The Adventures of Pete and Pete. I was not like a huge fan of the show. In fact, I think I was just completely baffled by it. I don't think my brain had fully evolved enough. You had a larger head than I did as a child, so you had more cranial space to process. I just don't think my frontal lobe was developed enough to fully take in its sort of surreal and mundane blend. But watching clips of it recently, and several episodes are available on YouTube with Hungarian subtitles. And I think that's one of the only ways you can see it right now.
It's not on DVD?
It's on DVD, yeah. There's physical release, but I don't think it's streaming. I don't think it's even streaming on whatever Paramount is. I think Paramount is the Nickelodeon streamer. But I've really come to appreciate its unique appeal and joys. I mean, for starters, it's a show that opens with a cold open about a character going to the beach to, quote, beat up the ocean. Not because he's angry, but because he's mad that summer is ending. He's not mad at the ocean.
I find it hard to believe that you didn't do that.
Well, then it proceeds directly into a credit sequence in which a metal plate in his mother's head gets its own credit. So that show is rubber.
And a tattoo.
And well, Petunia. But no, that show is rubber stamped into a hard win for me solely off those two things. What about you?
Yeah, this was a very special show for me because I was a big fan of Nick at Night and all the old-fashioned sitcoms that they would air late into the evening. And this always felt like a very subversive send-up of all that, of all those kind of like Leave It to Beaver-y, I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched.
Yeah, the creative team came out of the promo department, and so half their job was cutting promos for when Nickelodeon was rerunning those shows. So that's certainly, I think that's a valid observation.
Makes so much sense. This was also probably the closest to grunge that I ever really got at the time in the early 90s. I mean, which I guess I'm basing purely on Little Pete's Holden Caulfield plaid hat, maybe. And it definitely, there's a strong Pacific Northwest vibe in that show, I would say. I was shocked to learn that they actually filmed it in New Jersey. But yeah, I really appreciated the Gen X era Nickelodeon before it sort of went the way of the more kid-friendly, orange, splat, brightly colored Nicktoons, SpongeBob-type stuff, because it was a lot weirder and more surreal in the early 90s, or at least that's how it seemed to me. And in Pete and Pete specifically, I remember that there were elements of it that kind of made me sad. I don't know if you picked up on that.
I did, very much by design, actually.
Yeah, there's something really melancholic about it. And, you know, The end of the summer episode is a great example. And I always think of the one where, I think you mentioned it later on in the episode, where I think Little Pete's grounded and he tunnels through the yard using a Statue of Liberty toy or something.
And tunneling's and back just, in the news in a big way this week, baby.
But timely. We are nothing if not zeitgeisty, my friends. Yeah, it was just, it almost felt like you were watching a sitcom about a time that, even though it was contemporary, it had already gone by. It was very like Vaseline on the lens, almost Sandlot-y in a strange way. Mm. So did you watch it much when we were kids, or was this really your first exposure to like sitting down and watching full episodes?
No, I did remember watching it. I just remember like being like, what? And I think, I think I was just more keyed into the animated stuff of Nickelodeon at the time. I mean, except for Are You Afraid of the Dark and maybe a little of all that, but I was always way more into like Ren and Stimpy and Kablam and like some of the Angry Beavers and obviously Rugrats. And yeah, some of their live action stuff. I was like, these aren't cartoons, although they are.
They're very
much cartoon characters.
I loved all the live action stuff. I love Salute Your Shorts and this. And
I do remember Salute Your Shorts, mostly because of the theme song. The show Pete and Pete, The Adventures of Pete and Pete, is centered on the Wrigley family who live in the fictional suburb of Wellsville, which is just miles from the Canadian border, 500 miles from the Hoover Dam, and not far from the beach.
Again, Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, you're right. It actually does kind of give those vibes. And the brothers Big Pete, played by Mike Marana, and Little Pete, Danny Tamborelli, and their parents Don, played by Hardy Rawls, and Joyce, Judy Grafe. One key aspect of the series' combination of the surreal and mundane is how the two lead characters share just that one name, which is something never commented on by anyone in the show. They are always just referred to by each other and everyone else as Pete.
I love this. It reminds me of how in Arrested Development, it takes many, many episodes, possibly several seasons, for George Michael to say some throwaway joke about like, are you sure they're talking about me and not the singer-songwriter? I love that.
Vulture posited as being important to the DNA of two shows that followed it, Erie, Indiana, and Malcolm in the Middle. And Pete and Pete's plots and episodes tend to center around the fairly ordinary trials and tribulations of being a teenager and a family member and a kid at that transitional age, but with over-fictionalized and seemingly untethered from reality embellishments that pop up. You already mentioned the aforementioned Statue of Liberty show, but there's also a time-traveling plot connected to Daylight Savings Time, Mom's aforementioned metal plate in her head.
That she can pick up radio signals with,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure. Yes, 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 yes. You know, Pete has one tattoo that is explained and then a full back tattoo that is never explained. It's you know, the weirdness of it is it's not lampshaded. It's not drawn. It's not overemphasized. It's just how things are here. And so
I have a question for you before we continue. You have a number of tattoos. I was wondering, during the many occasions in which you received tattoos or chose tattoos, did Little Pete's tattoos of Petunia and the full back ship, I believe, tattoo, did that have any impact on you whatsoever?
I mean, it's funny. I haven't looked at his, like, I don't think there are high res versions of his ship tattoo available, but like that full that ship is like one of the many classic traditional tattoo archetypes, like the full rigging and mast thing, to the point where you see it in a lot of archival material from like traditional tattooing of the 50s and 60s.
Because these are probably the first tattoos I ever saw, like at least in a big way.
It's actually a very funny story because I have the bulk of my tattoos are from one artist in Brooklyn. Her name is Sue Jiven. She's an incredible woman. I wrote a story on her for People and, you know, she is...
And a song, too, right?
And one of our songs, yes. She's lived with stage 4 breast cancer for a very long amount of time and is just continuing to tattoo. And she was also one of the people who worked together with the ACLU to turn over the illegality of tattooing in Massachusetts. So she's an incredible woman, has an incredible life. And while I was at the studio that she worked at for a time... I chose her, and that studio is owned by another famous Brooklyn artist. And the reason I went with Sue is because that guy asked for like a $350 drawing fee, which is like a sort of controversial thing in the tattoo community about whether or not you can charge a drawing fee or whether or not that's included in the price, blah, blah, blah. So that scared me off. And then when I went there to actually show up for her first tattoo, he was doing a tattoo on another guy. And it was a tattoo that this guy's grandfather had gotten while he was in the Navy. And this guy asked him, and so this is in addition to the $350 drawing fee and the $200 or $300 an hour that this guy charged. This kid asked him if he could have the drawing because he wanted to get it framed. And the artist said no. Which was like, I was like, wow, f*** you, dude. I'm glad I went with Sue and a lifelong friendship was formed. Anyway, I don't know. That's all useless for you. Well, from the show's prolonged road from a series of shorts cooked up by renegades from Nickelodeon's promo division to a full-fledged series to its endless cavalcade of prominent guest stars to at least one of the Pete's explanations for their characters' names, here's everything you didn't know about the adventures of Pete. And Pete. It was that downtown Manhattan sensibility, Catherine Diekman, one of the show's three principal creatives, told Vulture. She worked on more episodes of this than any other director, and much of it sort of, as you mentioned, quasi-grunge, early 90s, Austin, Linkletter, Slacker, Flannel, Pacific Northwest, Kill Rock Stars, Elliot Smith, Silver Lake, Echo Park. Now I'm just bullshitting. That aesthetic is largely hers. She immediately goes on to say, that show could not have come out of L.A. It couldn't have come out of any number of cities you could mention. The sensibility was very much the world where Hal Hartley was making movies and where Jim Jarmusch made Stranger Than Paradise and where Steve Buscemi was doing these performance art pieces. All of us had come of age with the 80s New York sensibility in music and film and style and everything else, and we were all living in the same world. It was all part of one gestalt that was filtered into a children's show.
Thank you for sharing that weird Steve Buscemi skit the other day on YouTube, because I had no idea he was part of the downtown art scene in this era.
Me neither. And the other guy, I had no idea he was so tight with Marky Boone, Mark Boone Jr., who is like just like sort of one of the guys that Central Casting calls up whenever they need like a grizzled biker guy. I think he's probably most famous for a long-running role in Sons of Anarchy, but he's been in a ton of stuff, and just the fact that he also came out in that 80s scene, and you can see him in, like, I think that's, what was that clip from, 87, 88?
88, yeah.
Yeah, just him and Steve Buscemi just doing, like, essentially, like, improv free performance skit in, like, a very small room to no one. Really wild. And Steve Buscemi is a New York icon for another reason.
Yes, that's right. He was a volunteer fireman, and then he re-enlisted after 9/11 to help with the rescue effort. So we love Steve Buscemi.
And refused to answer any further questions about it other than simply saying, these are my brothers.
Really? Oh.
That was his quote, yeah.
Wow.
Diekman elaborated in Matthew Klickstein's monumental tome, Slimed, An Oral History of Nickelodeon's Golden Age, which should be required reading for anyone interested in this stuff. She said, improvisational DIY punk was very much our aesthetic. We're just going to take these kids and go to some suburbs in Jersey and shoot it, man. The show was filmed largely in Leonia, Jersey, with other locations in northern New Jersey as well, like Wayne, Cranford, and Bayonne. I like pronouncing Bayonne with a Cajun accent, like Bayonne, New Jersey. Sorry to the state of Louisiana.
Your inner kingfish.
The Cajun people. Can you imagine if Dr. John grew up in New Jersey? Can you imagine if Bruce Springsteen was Dr. John?
Can you imagine Bruce Springsteen grew up in Louisiana?
That would be funny, right? And probably awesome, actually.
Yeah.
That's the thought experiment I want to pursue.
Can you do Boyne the Run as done by Dr. John?
He'd probably say Boyne. He'd say boy.
Maybe we were Boyne to run.
Because isn't that that's the joke about Creedence, right? Is that they,
Born on the Bayou.
Boyne. Yeah. And it's like, dude, you're from Northern California. Anyway. Series co-creator Chris Viscardi said it was less conscious than that, though. He said, we were always into things like punk and punk rock and post-punk. All the important genres.
Pop punk. Yeah, punk.
Goth punk. And people like Iggy, obviously Iggy Pop, who guests repeatedly in the show. And we just wanted to bring those people to it. The third of the series creators, Will McRobb, told the AV Club that Pete and Pete's brain trust didn't even come from the traditional side of the network. He said, we were just promo guys for Nickelodeon. We spent our days promoting Mr. Ed and Donna Reed and Dennis the Menace, all shows that were on Nickelodeon at the time. And because Nickelodeon wasn't so much about, like, crushing Disney, it was more about, let's make a place that's great for kids. There was a lot of time in the commercial break to do image ads, as they were called, which didn't have to be about the shows. They could just be about, what is it like to be a kid?
Yeah, I mean, you said this earlier, it makes so much sense that Pete and Pete has this kind of fractured Nick at Night sitcom vibe.
Not to harp on my repeated point that capitalism is the death of all creativity and will kill us all, but it is insane how this show made it from 30-second interstitials to widely awarded shorts and then to a full series. That's like, I guess the equivalent of that would be like YouTube now, or to like Adult Swim, or like, I don't know, one of those
TikTok
and TikTokers. Yeah.
Well, wasn't, I mean, this is a stupid analogy, but The Simpsons were a cartoon segment on the Tracy Ullman sketch show. And then they were used to sell Butterfinger BBs, I think, before it launched as a sitcom.
So maybe capitalism does breed innovation.
This is the beginning of Heigl's slow turn towards the right.
You come back, I have like a haircut, and I'm all like, you know, you're really not embodying an abundance mindset right now, Jordan. TMI, grind set. Rise and grind.
Well, as you mentioned, Pete and Pete started as shorts that were originally supposed to be about Pete and his dog named Pete. And these premiered in the spring of 1989. Part of the creative brain trust, Will McRobb told the AV Club, "We initially were going to do it in a cheaper way. It was going to be more like a documentary style approach because that was cheaper. And we were going to do that with Adam Bernstein, the director. And then at my high school reunion, my 10-year high school reunion at Ithaca High School that summer, I ran across film and music video director Catherine Diekman, who was much cooler than I was in high school. 10 years on, she was doing REM videos, and I was feeling like I was the king of Nickelodeon. And we connected." Diekman was indeed, as you write, cool as hell. She'd been writing as a frustrated journalist in her 20s, writing for, among other places, The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, and Vogue. In her words, mostly on film, sometimes on music. In 1986, she did a piece on REM's Michael Stipe, and the two had actually become lifelong friends. And later she said, "Michael asked me, kind of out of the blue, to direct a music video for him." She took Stipe up on his offer and made Stand in 1989, and then attended that fateful 10-year high school reunion soon after.
I hate that f***ing song.
I know, it's one of the least good.
It's got that truck driver key change at the end. God.
But I do remember the video.
Yes, me too.
So, yeah, right? I mean, it's kind of, I remember that.
It all comes out in the wash.
Yeah. Was it automatic for the people named after a, like a fried chicken place or something, or a barbecue place, and that was something that the chef would call out from the kitchen when he was like serving up orders?
The f*** did you just say to me?
Never mind.
All right.
Diekman told Vulture, "I did a storyboard for them, and for the first 60-second spot about little Pete's tattoo, Petunia, which Will had written. The reason I got the job was when Mom sees Pete's tattoo, my drawing for her face was a wooden spoon covered in chocolate pudding hitting the floor." I like that. It's a great visual. Diekman wasn't the only music video fluent creative. Adam Bernstein, who we mentioned earlier, the director, who's gone on to work on Fargo and 30 Rock, directed music videos for They Might Be Giants and Beastie Boys.
Yeah, he was nominated for his work on Fargo and won an Emmy for 30 Rock.
Oh, wow. Should I watch 30 Rock?
Jordan, for the 17,000th time, yes. Like, I know you're traumatized by screenwriting school, but yes, yes, you should.
McRobb continued to the AV Club, "Once Chris Viscardi met Catherine, it really felt like a great mix. And with Catherine's input, we decided to make these little shorts into movies. They shot nearly 20 of these shorts over the course of 2 years." Now, at the time, Nickelodeon's programming department, according to all of the creative brain trust for Pete and Pete, was this big lumbering machine that made the shows and had a million people giving input, just like it is now. It wasn't designed for speed or creativity, really, and the promo department was just this little punk division in the midst of all this more corporate stuff, so we were free to do what we wanted to do. Basically, they said, "You've made 29-minute-long pieces. Why don't you just make a show now?"
From there, they made 5 half-hour specials, all of which won ACE Awards, which were, I think someone described it as sort of the Emmys of children's television at the time, or cable television at the time, because cable was so relatively new. But McRobb continued, "Nickelodeon still would not have gone to series without a producer that had done shows for them. I think he was doing The Secret World of Alex Mack at the time, this guy Tommy Lynch, who's a friend of ours and became like the ultimate friend of Pete and Pete. He was putting together a deal with Nickelodeon to do more shows. He saw the specials and said, well, how come this isn't a series? And we're like, well, you know, they work fine in specials, but we're not sure we want to invest in it as a series. And he's like, well, hell, if I'm making a deal with you guys, I want this to be one of the shows. I will turn this into a show. I will be the executive producer of the show and get it on the air. And at that point, Nickelodeon thought, well, if Tommy Lynch thinks it's good enough to make into a series, why should we give it to him? We'll make it. And that's the real story. It took somebody else wanting to make it for them to think, well, maybe we'll make it. And that's what really got us into the first season. Ah, the industry.
Catherine Diekman also traces a thread from Pete and Pete to quasi-sad childhood-focused sitcoms like our beloved Freaks and Geeks. From the beginning, Pete and Pete was all about this melancholy and emotionality of childhood as much as it was absurdist, she says in Slimed. We sort of took that approach to talking about childhood, which was not sentimental and not corny and not obvious. It was more about the strange things that happen in childhood and how truthful those are. See, I love that because there's so many things that we just sort of take as, you know, fact as children that years later we look back on and just think, what the hell is that all about?
Yeah.
McRobb said, also in Slimed, we really got off on putting together ideas that were on the surreal side of things. A summer vacation where nobody knows the identity of the guy who brings them ice cream every year, which was an emotionally traumatized story about a guy who can't handle intimacy. I remember that one.
I love that one. Yeah, that's the one where Michael Stipe guest stars. Of course, since the three show creators were all in their 20s and none of them had kids, as Diekman told Vulture, none of us had any idea what kids were like, except maybe from our own childhood, which Will and I referenced a lot. Chris grew up in Auburn, which was like 30 minutes away from Ithaca, and so we all had a similar frame of what the childhood experience was and what mattered and how we wanted to express that. She added, in Slimed, it was more about the strange things that happened in childhood and how truthful those are. We put that idea into our downtown New York sensibility, and that's really what Pete and Pete was. McRobb added in Slimed, it was a very square show masquerading as a hip show. The values were really like, love your brother and be good to people and honor your imagination. There was some subversive behavior, like staying up for 11 nights in a row, which is The Nightcrawlers, directed by Diekman and her favorite episode. But if you remember, at the end of that episode, Pete and Mom are closer than ever, and they respect each other's boundaries. We really honored the rituals of childhood.
McRobb told Vulture, we really believed in Nickelodeon, and at the time it was designed to be the anti-Disney. Which is funny, because earlier, didn't he just say that Nickelodeon at that time wasn't designed to take down Disney?
Yeah, that phrase anti-Disney comes up so much when they're talking about this era of Nickelodeon, and I actually don't really remember, or I don't really know if that was just sort of the unofficial creative like log line or who knows.
But I find it really interesting the way he elaborated on that. He said Disney was about a certain way of looking at childhood and Nickelodeon was about trying to capture what it was.
Yeah. I like that a lot as well.
Yeah. Chris Viscardi. I've gotten Chris Viscardi, Will McRobb, and Catherine Diekman all confused about what exactly they do, but those are the three who are responsible for creating and bringing Pete and Pete to life. Chris Viscardi used the Neil Young adjacent term ragged glory to describe he and McRobb's shared aesthetic, explaining that, quote, things don't always add up and don't always look very pretty, and sometimes the dots don't connect, but there's a certain glory and beauty in that. And we definitely strive to achieve that on Pete and Pete. McRobb elaborated, if things got neatly tied up in a bow, we would untie them. I thought that said urinate on them, which is different. Or we'd do a funny cutaway to somebody that would disrupt the scene in a way, like I just did. Or we would give Toby a chance to do some weirdo antics.
Toby Huss, who plays Artie, the strongest man in the world.
Yes. To do some weirdo antics in the middle of the scene just to undercut some slightly sentimental dialogue. Things that would give it a certain weirdo edge. It might not completely make sense in the long run, but something to us that felt kind of glorious and fun.
The simple look of the show, which was a single camera setup as opposed to three, it was shot on location as opposed to in the studio. It had a more cinematic, perhaps filmy appearance as opposed to the more conventional stage TV aesthetic, set Pete and Pete apart from the other live-action Nickelodeon shows that were shot at the network studios, like Clarissa Explains It All, or Are You Afraid of the Dark, which was imported from the bacony hinterlands of Canada. We didn't know a lot about making TV, but we knew that we wanted to make it look different than any other show on the air, Viscardi said. And that was one of the reasons that we hired Catherine. She had a very distinct style. It was very playful and light, and we loved her use of cutaways and found footage. It gave it a real arts and craftsy feel, which we really loved. But this didn't mean the show wasn't labored over. John Inwood, the show's cinematographer, says in Slimed that with Pete and Pete, there was an effort to choreograph the show in a way that would give it a design from the beginning to end and from scene to scene. That's not the style right now, he was saying this in 2003, where we have the documentaryization of shows like Parks and Recreation, which he had just worked on, so he's coming from a place of authority. Those shows embrace a looser, messier documentary style. Student executives have embraced that because it's led to shorter days, quicker shooting time periods, and the bottom line is, it's cheaper. Catherine Diekman, with her background, and admittedly taking influence from filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard, labored over the sound cues to the edits of that show. Allison Finelli, who played the character of Ellen, says in Slimed, picking music and sound effects was kind of Will and Chris and Catherine's baby. They spent hours and hours just going through the stock music and using the stuff that no one else had had. Catherine would search for hours to just get 10 seconds on the show. And regardless of whether imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, Diekman isn't having it. The next quote that follows in Slimed comes from her. It kind of got on my nerves because SpongeBob and all these shows completely stole that idea and went to the exact same cues, in fact. Oh yeah, I know those cues, she said while she was watching them, because I found them for Pete and Pete. They were all in the stock library, but nobody was using them that way.
I wonder what they were. Did she give any examples?
I mean, the history of like stock libraries is really interesting because there's like a ton of it that would have been recorded, like British stock sitcom music. There's like a ton of it recorded by like Ace session guys who were like the killer jazz musicians on the scene at the time. The KPM music library, there's a bunch of it on the streamers. Oh, wow. It's like ripping like incidental jazz funk stuff. But they might have had through Nickelodeon's, through Paramount, I guess, like that kind of stock library. It might have also been classical music, you know.
Serious question. I wonder if Jimmy Page played on any of those British sitcom.
That's a great question. I mean,
who just turned 80 recently.
Yeah, and is dating probably a 17-year-old.
I'll say one of Rock's most prolific pederasts. Adding to Pete and Pete's weirdly timeless but also influential aesthetic was the wardrobe choices, which mostly came about as a function of practicality. Allison Finelli, who played Ellen, the best friend slash love interest of Big Pete. Love interest, right? At least yeah. Towards the end of the series. Yeah. She says in the book Slimed, we had to wear a lot of our own clothes. You couldn't wear anything too trendy, and we couldn't identify the state or town we were in. Janie Bryant, who designed the show and went on to work on Mad Men, added, I always loved using vintage pieces because I felt it was a great way to express these characters who were so quirky. The show about this special world, the special neighborhood, and using those accents of vintage pieces combined with contemporary clothing made the show look incredibly special. It almost has a Wes Anderson aesthetic to it. It totally does. Pete and Pete were these kids who were dressing like adults. That's the beginning of the inspiration. I live in Silver Lake, a neighborhood in Los Angeles, and it's true. All the hipsters look like characters from Pete and Pete. Although that book was written probably like 15 years ago, but...
Yeah, fashion has moved on, but...
Yeah. Big Pete actor Mike Marana told Vulture, Chris and Will were both upstate New York preppies. Catherine was a music video director and more bohemian with the crazy hats. Big Pete was dressed more like a preppy and Little Pete dressed more like a trucker or a mechanic. I guess Catherine won in the case of Danny. I think it was also her projecting herself more onto Allison, who had a fun wardrobe. Allison is Ellen, the girl next door. McRobb added, we were trying to make Little Pete a badass. The hat was more about Holden Caulfield than grunge, and he only wore long-sleeve shirts to cover his tattoo. And as we mentioned at the top of the episode, fans will remember that Pete's forearm has a tattoo of Petunia. She's a mermaid, right? A mermaid or like one of the figures on the front of a ship?
Hang on. I thought she was a mermaid, but someone called it a pinup.
Why can't it be both?
Yeah, mermaids can be pinups. No, she has legs. It's just like a leggy redhead.
Really? Now I want to look this up. I mean, not that I don't trust you. It's just, oh, yeah. But there is like a nautical vibe about her, right? Yeah.
Temporary tattoos, if you want it.
What'd you
I
say?
Said they make temporary tattoos of her if you want to go for that vibe.
That's my 2024 energy. In an early Pete and Pete short, it is explained that Little Pete got the tattoo of Petunia as a Mother's Day gift, infuriating his father and causing his mother to faint. The ship tattoo on his back, however, is never explained.
As you meditate on that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information after these messages.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Pretty much all of the show's creatives were a fan of Mark Mulcahy of Miracle Legion, who eventually produced the show's anthemic theme song, Hey Sandy, which we will listen to now.
It's a great song.
It's kind of strange. You look at the leading rain. I can't be settled in bed. Or have you picked your target yet? Hey Sandy.
I do love this song.
It whips and completely unintelligible.
Is there a full version of that? I guess not.
I didn't look that much into it, but there probably has been in the intervening 30 years.
The band's Polaris, right? It's like a made up band name.
Will McRobb and I had lunch together, Mulcahy recalls in Slimed. At the time, Miracle Legion was having legal trouble and nobody in the band wanted to do it. I had a partner in the band and we wrote most of the songs and he didn't want to do it. So Miracle Legion couldn't do the music. I had never written music on my own, but I volunteered to do it anyway. And then I presented him with the song, Hey Sandy, and the rest is where we are now. People have obsessed over what the hell Mulcahy is saying in that theme song for the intervening decades, and apparently, while it's something that the people connected with the show enjoy and or laugh about, it wasn't by design. Diekman says in Slimed, believe me, if Mark could concoct a mystery that people would talk about this many years later, but I know that he didn't. He's not that calculating. The performance video was shot in 3 or 4 hours. Mulcahy recalls being asked to jump around and up and down. Get up, and get down. If you got the feeling, jump across the ceiling. Which he did not want to do. So, of course, for one take, he acquiesced and did just that. And that's where most of the footage comes from. He said, I had never written a theme song to anything. So I certainly didn't have any reason to think that it would be a successful theme song. But it was.
It's like that sometimes. Catherine Diekman later told Vulture, the show kind of evolved through our shared taste in terms of the way the kids looked and the way it was shot and the kind of kids they were. They weren't going to be show-busy kids at all, and that helped set the tone for the show. Chris Viscardi told the AV Club of casting their titular leads with Danny Tamborelli for Little Pete. He just came in the room and he was the kid. He just had that kind of firecracker quality to him. He was funny and he was adorable and he was small and you just know it. The kid had a certain electricity to him. And Michael Morana, Big Pete, there are many things we could say about Michael with the casting, but his energy was just very different than Danny, and the contrast between them was very funny. Michael was definitely much more cerebral. Not that Danny's not smart, but Michael Morana just approaches things in a much more cerebral way. He's a little bit more sarcastic and wry and dry. You contrast that with Danny and his character, who's just a little bit more of a punchy-in-the-face kind of a kid, and it was a pretty great combination. I don't know if we knew it right away that Michael was the one, but we definitely knew he was in the top two or three. New York native Marano was cast at a weird time in his life. He later told Vulture, "When I got the show in the summer of 89, I was 11 turning 12 and had just started at a new school. Turning into an adolescent was part of my everyday life at that point, and it's not surprising that that came out in the character. I'm grateful for that." Marano also played big brother to Kevin McAllister in the first two Home Alone films, but those were easier for him to see than his early work in the Pete and Pete shorts. He said, "I didn't have cable TV growing up. We only got it after Pete and Pete went into series production. So we used to go up and down the block on Saturday nights to my sister's friend's house to watch the first 30-second episodes air in between a couple of Nickelodeon shows." Hardy Rawls, who played Pete's dad, who I remember being kind of abusive. Is that just classic sitcom dad?
He was a man of his time.
Okay. He said in Slimed, "Danny and Michael were incredibly smart kids and knew their scripts. They had to be just as professional as the adults, but also kids on camera. Whereas as an actor on camera, I acted like a big kid and got paid for it." Toby Huss added that Artie's in-show honorific for the kids, Little Vikings, came from him being impressed by Murata and Tamborelli's work ethic. Can you do an Archie?
I didn't prep anything for this one. I didn't have any of those in my pocket. I love Toby Huss. So you ever see the maligned two or three season HBO show Carnival?
No. Oh, no. He's in that.
Yeah, he's in there. He's great.
It was Archie or Arnie? Arnie! Strongest man in the world. Almost. That's a... Considering I hadn't prepared that.
Hi. Yeah, that was pretty good off the top.
Yeah.
As for the names, Marana told the
what
ringer.
What are the names?
Pete and Pete.
Oh, okay.
We tend to just make up reasons when people ask us at conventions and stuff like that. This one is my favorite. When I was born, our dad wasn't there. And when little Pete was born, our mom wasn't there. So they just ended up picking the same name somehow.
That's good.
As good as any, honestly. Most adorably, the two Petes are still friends and had a podcast that ran for almost 10 years. They reconnected in Brooklyn, in fact, when Marana happened to see Tamborelli at McCarran Park on the Williamsburg-Greenpoint border during the park's mid-aughts heyday of hosting indie bands at the pool. The day was pretty hot, and Tamborelli was pretty hungover. And soon after we connected, he proceeded to puke in between two cars there on Lorimer Street, Marana told The Ringer. There was an earlier, sadder meeting in 1997. Marana was living in New York and working as a bike messenger, and he ran into Danny at an audition, and his bike had just been stolen, so Danny's father gave him a ride home.
Aww.
It's really cute that they're friends, though, and that Danny Tamborelli like has fronts and plays bass in a band.
Yeah, didn't he used to work at like some hip Lower East Side, I want to say like Pianos or something?
Mm.
Arlene's Grocery, one of those places, or maybe he just played there a lot. Because I thought I remember I had like friends that used to come across him.
That tracks.
Actually, one of the executive producers of this show, Noel Brown, I think, knows Danny Tamborelli. I think he like pitched him a podcast or something. I don't know. I forget how they're connected. Hmm. Did you ever used to go see shows at McCarran Park?
It was kind of phasing out by the time that I had gotten there. I was doing, I remember seeing stuff at Northside when Northside was a thing. And CMJ, when CMJ was a thing.
We don't have things anymore.
No, it's all just content. No, I saw Guided by Voices, and one of the funniest interactions I ever had was with a guy I was playing in a band with at the time. He's real head in the sand guy about a lot of stuff, and he was like, "Who are these again?" I was like, "They're Guided by Voices." And he's like, "Are they British?" And I was like, "No, they're just wasted."
Yeah, I think the one band I saw at the pool was, oh man, one of those like two syllable band names from like the late aughts.
Art Brut.
Mau Mau. Mau Mau. Tap Tap. Rat-a-tat.
Juju?
Man.
Oh, Man. I love Man.
It's Man Man. Took me a second. I found it.
They're Philly boys.
Are they? Huh. Danny Tamborelli seems to have enjoyed his time on Pete and Pete. He talks in Slimed about how his parents worked to keep him grounded. He worked in a bagel store while filming All That, a couple years after Pete and Pete, and played basketball and baseball while doing Pete and Pete. And he maintained a social circle by inviting his friends from school to come and act as extras on the show. I love that. As you mentioned, he's still a musician, playing bass and fronting a band called Jounce. It's just a great name. And in fact, he got his first bass for an episode of Pete and Pete, which we'll get to in a second. He does, however, have a telling quote later on. He said, "I don't really know where I stopped being myself and started being Pete." or the other way around.
Yeah, it was in a section about how these kids kind of dealt with some of their fame, and Rick Gomez, who plays Endless Mike, or
that's a great name.
Yeah, it just really is. He was talking about how he was like in New York with Mike Morona, and people were like running after him, screaming Pete. He was like, "Oh." apparently Danny Tamborelli gave, or is still giving, we have no way of knowing, Kenan Thompson guitar lessons. That's just cute. And he has a sketch comedy group called Man Boobs, which is less cute.
I wonder if that's still going on. Is that still going on, or is that from like 10 years ago?
The sketch thing? Or,
yeah.
Oh, I don't know. What? Who gives a shit? I think I'm going to Google a sketch comedy group called Man Boobs. I cherish my algorithm too much for that. Little Pete's torrent of kid insults did occasionally cause problems with the network. McRobb told Vulture, "We could say blowhole and fudge liquor, but we couldn't say nipple," which was pretty arbitrary.
Were there any insults that you had as a kid that you were particularly beloved by you?
I think I got a lot of mileage out of fart. But then I read the novelization of the movie Blade when I was like 10, and that introduced me to motherfucker. And so I was cursing a blue streak pretty early. TBQH.
Did you swear around your parents?
No, I didn't cross that Rubicon until like I was into college. Now I do all the time. Constantly. So does my sister, which is amazing. She curses like a sailor.
My sister and I still don't. That's why part of the reason why I fought to have a censor beeps on this show.
Aw. Sorry, I'm here f***ing it up for you. He said with a mouthful of sandwich. Tamborelli continued to work for Nick after Pete and Pete went off the air, but he admitted to The Ringer that he and Morona were in different places in their life at that time. We were in that moment of being just old enough where, if you went to first grade and fifth grade, then yeah, we're in the same elementary school. But if you're not in the same middle school and you miss each other in high school, I was dropping into high school as Mike was dropping into LSD. I mean, college.
I'd like to unpack that at some point.
They have a great rapport. I didn't listen to like a ton of the podcast that they had, but it's funny.
Viscardi told the AV Club of Allison Finelli, who played Ellen, the girl next door, "We knew right away when we saw her because she was just so different and so quirky and so charming and so much like a little adorable girl next door." So casting can be a brutal process because you can see hundreds upon hundreds of people who are just wrong the minute you lay eyes on them. But then somebody walks through the door and it's like, hallelujah, that's the one. In Slimed, Finelli recalled the literal and figurative growing pains of doing the show during such a pivotal time in her life. She said, "I got to a point where every scene they were putting powder on my face because we were just oily teenagers." After a while, they were more conscious about giving us different dressing spaces instead of trading off in the same space. But mine was near Michael and Danny's. It was super awkward. She added, "We were all really close, and it was really hard for Michael Morona and me when they started writing the romantic stuff on Pete and Pete. The kisses were absolutely horrific for us both. Both times, we avoided each other for an entire week." Aww. Morona also experienced some hormone-related issues during that time. Judy Grafe, who played his mom, said, "Something everybody noticed was when Michael's voice was changing. We were all like, what does that mean? Is he still going to be Pete? Then, once he was becoming an early teen idol, all the young girls were coming to the sets, all off Twitter over him. That was something we noticed, too." Finelli, who played Ellen, told YouTuber Christopher Nosey that Catherine Diekman, one of the creators of the show, was in fact one of her heroes, and she'd been interested in going into directing. But at the tail end of high school, she happened to take a medical science class. "I absolutely fell in love with it," she said, "and I sort of started thinking, hey, maybe I'd like to do something like that." She added, "I was applying to colleges and freaking my whole family out, who were like, you've acted your whole life. You wanted to direct. You've been doing musical theater. What in the world are you talking about?" It was the hardest thing ever, but I stuck with it. And she's now a pediatric specialist in Philadelphia. Probably the only known case of somebody whose parents are like, wait, you want to give up acting and
become a doctor?
Be a doctor?
We found him. We found the one.
But Heigl, now we're going to talk about the darling of the show.
God, dude, I had such a crush on Michelle Trachtenberg. Mostly from Harriet the Spy, but...
Yeah.
And then Buffy, but man, it's a special place in heaven for redheaded women. She played Nona, She remembers her time on the show fondly, recalling in Slimed, her parents never forced her into her early acting gigs. That's the difference between having stage parents, not actually having the choice to be on set, and people like me, who absolutely loved it. I would hate going back to the school because I would always want to be on the set. If anything, I would be too excited to be there and have to remember to calm down. She also added, adorably at first, and then creepily, Danny Tamborelli was probably among my first crushes. The lead singer of New Kids on the Block, Green Day, and maybe Danny. So that was fun as a little girl discovering boys, and then the music goes to a minor chord. A lot of growing up happened for me on the Pete and Pete show. Want to dig into that?
Is there a quote after that? Yeah.
Trachtenberg, who went on to anchor Nickelodeon's Harriet the Spy adaptation, does describe one of her most vivid Pete and Pete memories as a legitimate trauma. In Slimed, there was a scene where a bunch of us were walking to a fence. We're supposed to drag because it was the hottest, longest day of the year. And there was a boy who had ADD and his parent didn't watch him, and he went and had like 20 sugar packets from the craft service table. When action was called, he got really upset because the director told us to go really, really slowly. I was going slowly, and he shoved me down and ran to the fence because he was on a sugar high. I happened to fall on my knee and slice it open on a piece of glass that randomly was there. So I've always had a scar on my knee for that one day. I went to my school trailer, put a bunch of Band-Aids on it, and said, we gotta finish the scene. Finally, when we were done with the whole day, when I got into the car to go home at night, I burst into tears. I don't know why I included that. That's a real downer.
Damn. Yeah, that's a rare dark cloud in this story.
F*** that kid. Well, I don't know who he is, but I'll find him if he made Michelle Trachtenberg hurt.
I kind of guess it was Danny Tamborelli.
You think so?
Well, here to take us out of this this sad diversion is Toby Huss, who plays Hardy, the strongest man in the world. There we go. That wasn't bad.
That was good. Yeah.
It was passable.
Have you ever seen Michelle Trachtenberg in Road Trip?
No.
You ever seen Road Trip? Or Euro Trip?
I was going to say Road Trip I've seen.
Yeah.
No.
Ugh. God, I love her. She's a pretty lady. Just a pretty lady. After I saw that Harriet the Spy movie, I made a spy backpack and went around my neighborhood spying on people. Pretty cool. Binoculars, notebook.
Did you find anything?
Nope, not a damn thing. Suburbs were boring.
Oh, yeah, what was all in it?
Binoculars, notebook, flashlight, obviously, multi-tool.
Multi-tool?
Yeah.
To pick locks?
No, just like open vents and stuff.
That's I'd say a step up from picking locks is that you are not even using a door. You are
using vents. I plead the fifth. And I brought my game gear too, so that I could be in disguise. And like, if I was while spying on people, I would pretend to be playing Game Gear. This occupied weeks of my life one summer.
Did you get caught?
No.
No trouble at all?
No, not a single come up and say, I genuinely don't remember seeing anything interesting.
Did you commit any crimes or anything that would be potentially labeled a crime?
Define crime.
Trespassing, stalking.
Definitely trespassing. Theft. No stalking. Yeah. I didn't steal anything. I only steal from corporations, Jordan. I don't steal from people. I did shoplift so much as a kid.
Anything good?
Mostly action figures and stuff, but
that's good.
Just love to steal.
The only thing I ever stole were those little plastic things that were on the top of clothing hangers that would say small, medium, or large.
So you could organize your closet at home? Organize your sweaters? I ever
feel real guilty about that. Yeah.
Two roads diverged in a wood. Us as children.
I was more of a Hardy Boys guy, so I didn't.
Of course you were. Chaotic, good. No, lawful good. They were fascists secretly. They were authoritarian.
They were narcs. They were narcs.
Yeah. Harriet just wanted information. She wanted compromat. You know, I can get behind that. This is one of our weirder digressions.
The slightly unlawful sleuthing of a tween girl. Yeah, this is up there on the things that were going to get us an FCC warning.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful Beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
But now back to Artie. I haven't heard that guy's voice probably 30 years, but I hear it in my heart. Toby House, who played Artie, was described by guest star Janine Garofalo to Vulture as the king of downtown Lower East Side. He initially created the character of Artie at No Shame Theater at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. In Huss's original iteration of the character, Artie was a patient in an insane asylum who would declare himself the strongest man in the world before playing the piano and then screaming. Another actor would then spray him with a hose, causing him to calm down and repeat the routine. Which, in a way, I feel like is an apt summation of our show. We alternate who does the spraying.
Yeah, yeah. So your turn this week.
The character was reworked so that his delusions were real in order to make him more child-friendly. Kind of reminds me how on Sesame Street, Snuffy was originally an imaginary character for, like, the first 20 years until I think only Big Bird could see him. And then the people who made Sesame Street decided to make him visible to everybody because they just thought it was confusing to kids and they didn't want to basically encourage, like, delusions, essentially.
Agreed.
So that's interesting. The costume for Artie, Huss says, came from his University of Iowa days, and the glasses were a pair of women's eyeglasses from a thrift store, which he still owns, bringing us a long-delayed return to our It Belongs in a Museum segment. Despite the comedic origins, in the show's world, Artie is played completely straight-faced and received as such, though the town's parents' resentments eventually lead him to depart Wellsville in the heartbreaking season 2 story, Farewell, My Little Vikings, in which Artie departs town, having finally helped Pete, I imagine Little Pete, to grow up and stand up for himself. Chris Viscardi noted that Nickelodeon was not happy with them dedicating so much time to Artie. The executives at Nickelodeon, as we've talked about, kind of stayed away and let us do our thing, except on certain occasions. I do remember that they were not happy with the fact that we were making it a two-parter. I guess the final episode for Artie, the Farewell to the Vikings episode, was a two-parter. Artie, to them, was a confusing, unsettling character. A guy in underwear running around suburbia with little kids thinking he was a strong man. Certainly the executives at Nickelodeon, and I'm sure many parents out in the world who were watching the show with their kids, probably felt the same way as Pete's dad and all the neighborhood folks did for Artie. They wanted the guy to go away. I liked Artie.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I think I remembered him as like an imaginary friend. And then going back and rewatching this, I was like, oh yeah, no, it's just a real dude running around town.
You ever I guess we were just talking about this earlier. You remember something you haven't revisited in decades. And you think there's no way it looks as weird and bizarre as I remember it being. And then you see it again and you're like, oh, yeah, no, my memory isn't faulty.
Yeah.
I wasn't just a kid who didn't know the world. It's just as weird as I remember. I just Googled Artie and yep. Yeah, right on the money. It's, I mean, it is mind blowing to me that a show like this ever got made, you know? I mean, it really speaks to just the lawlessness of television, cable television.
It's so great. Endless Mike Hellstrom. What a great name. Did you know that it was supposed to be because his hatred of Big Pete was endless?
No.
I think that was what I read on Wikipedia. I wasn't able to get confirmation of that. Big Pete's arch nemesis, a classic peaked too early guy with a position of power he lorded over shop class. His white leather shoes, which is like the only thing that I remember about his character other than his name, were from Janie Bryant. He has one of the best quotes about Pete and Pete in Slimed, which is, Pete and Pete had two fans, 10-year-old kids and college students who were stoned out of their minds, which is what I was. Rick Gomez has continued to act following the show, and Mike Marana joked to an interview at one point, yeah, I just saw him in something terrible. That Transformers movie, dressing down Shia LaBeouf. But good for him, though.
We had a bully at our high school that everyone referred to as Massive Mike. It's just pretty good. Did you have any?
We didn't. No, I mean, I had specific enemies, but we didn't have like one dude who was like the capital T B bully.
I mean, I don't know if he. I think he was definitely just the most colorful in terms of his name. There was also a guy, and he gave himself this nickname, so I don't feel bad saying it. Sloth. Did I ever tell you about Sloth? Like, so named because he kind of resembled Sloth from the Goonies.
That's bad.
He bestowed this name on himself. His claim to fame in our neighborhood was his dad. This is a weird thing about Massachusetts, is it really straddles the line between being extremely lefty PBS tote bag, granola eating, you know, Subaru driving people, and then survivalists. His dad said that if he lost some amount of weight, he would buy him an AK-47. And so in a very Pete and Pete-esque twist, this guy, I think he read a book about the Roman army, and he filled a camping backpack filled with stones and would just run across our neighborhood over and over again.
Yeah, that's
with
normal.
A backpack full of stones?
Yeah, dude, it's just
in order
basic
to get an AK-47?
Well, maybe not.
Stop me when the stop becomes normal.
Yeah, I mean, mostly the you know, the to get an AK-47 thing, but no, you know, you just like you never run around with a bunch of stones? It's for strength training purposes.
My house was on the route that the girls track team ran at my high school. And one time I was filming something embarrassing for like a sketch we were putting together for some like talent show night. And I was always the MC, and I would always have to film dumb video sketches in between acts or whatever. And I'm pretty sure I was standing in my living room in my underwear, and the front door was all glass. And then they were running by, and the captain of the girls track team was my good friend, Laura. And she waved and called my name, and the entire girls track team, it was like a Monty Python bit, were all waving at me, hi Jordan. And it was like, you know, 40-50 of the hottest girls in school, and I'm standing in my living room in boxer shorts with my friend filming me just out of sight, so it just looks like I'm standing in my living room in my underwear. Yeah, it was bad.
I mean, that's kind of a power move.
Sure, but it wasn't. Because you've seen me in my, actually no you haven't, because even when we were on tour, I would change in the bathroom.
Yeah, I haven't. Yeah. We didn't see a lot of. We didn't explore each other's bodies very much on that tour.
I didn't even drive on that tour. I can't believe you let me get away with that.
Yeah, I shouldn't have. So, what was up with Mom's plate? What's the deal?
Yeah.
That apparently just came from the story of a baseball player and a coach named Don Zimmer, who had to have a metal plate put in his head after receiving a blow to the head by a ball in the 1950s. According to an article, though, in Nickelodeon Magazine, it was specifically a skiing accident that forced Mom's plate to be inserted into her head. It's only mentioned as in the show as like a from a medical procedure or something, like they
don't. Well, I would hope so.
Well, yeah, but they don't specify it. I mean, but I guess in the expanded Nickelodeon universe, if you got Nickelodeon Magazine, you found out the real juice, which is that it was from a skiing art. You know, that thing I just said. I always thought it was a nod to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, where the guy has a metal plate in his head and he keeps holding a lighter over a stretched out coat hanger and scratching his plate skin with it.
Oh, God.
Oh, it's real gross. I love that movie. And the rest. The show is probably the most famous to non-obsessive as being that weird Nickelodeon sitcom with a shitload of famous cameos, which is accurate. Michael Stipe pops up in the first full-length episode thanks to Diekman's connection to the band, but he was hardly the only musician to grace the show. Kate Pearson of the B-52s, Debbie Harry, The Apples in Stereo, The Magnetic Fields, Gordon Gano of the Violent Femmes, David Johansen of the New York Dolls, and Juliana Hatfield were all guests on the show at one point. Johansen, who was obviously the frontman of the New York Dolls and then also recorded as Buster Poindexter, who you have to thank for
Hot,
yeah, and The Ghost of Christmas Past and Scrooged.
Wow.
He was asked to come aboard Pete and Pete as the unlikely park ranger Thorson in the episode On Golden Pete. Those kids hung out in the scene, Johansen told Vulture of the creators. It was a good show. Very kind of avant-garde. It had a nice dreamlike vibe to it. It was like working on an indie movie. Low-key, very enjoyable. Like being in a camp. It was fun. Real people. Funky. Cool. No one was a blowhard. He elucidated on that in Slimed, saying that the actors on Pete and Pete were good kids, not like your typical asshole kid stars. That was very refreshing. He's hilarious, dude. I interviewed him once, and I was like, you know, being very earnest, I was like, yeah, you're one of the, like, big Manhattan, downtown Manhattan icons, but you're, like, you know, you've lived in Staten Island your whole life. Like, what... Big up Staten Island for us. Like, what do you love about Staten Island? He just, there's this long pause on the phone, and then he just goes, well, I hear the ferry's nice. Juliana Hadfield's, her obvious non-musical charms, we'll say. Mike Marana told The Ringer when he was asked by an interviewer about her specifically. He said, we are men, are we not? We're not made of stone. We are made of flesh and blood and muscle and sinew, right? We breathe. We live. I just had to include that. I'm just going to start saying that as my all-purpose explanation for anything, mostly when pretty ladies are concerned. We are made of flesh and blood and muscle and sinew. We breathe. We live.
Have you seen that thing that's been memed all to hell where it was like a woman on like a British kids show talking to a puppet?
Yeah.
We're just normal men.
We're just innocent men. But of course, the biggest and most iconic. Oh, that's you. Sorry, I was going to run.
Yeah. But of course, the biggest, most iconic name attached to the show was Iggy Pop.
Yes.
Who played Nona, Michelle Trachtenberg's dad. Chris Viscardi told the AV Club, because we had Michael Stipe and Kate Pearson and Steve Buscemi and various others in the first season, it started to get a little bit easier for us to at least have the talent folks at Nickelodeon get calls back from the people who represented these rock and rollers. I think it was the Stipe factor for sure that helped us get Iggy. But I don't think anybody on the show, unless I'm mistaken, had any connection with Iggy. I think they just went through his agents and managers and sent him the script and some episodes. Viscardi continued to Vulture, we just thought, who would be the most unexpected choice to be a suburban dad and put a guy in a cardigan and khaki pants? Obviously, we're all huge Iggy fans, so we reached out to him. And when he said yes, I don't think myself or Will or Catherine had ever been happier. It was just so weird and wonderful. He could not have been sweeter and funnier and more lovely with the kids. He was totally not what you'd expect and super eager. He was like, yeah, I'll do whatever you want. And we brought him back a number of times.
Yeah, Tamborelli has the best story regarding Iggy's time on the show. He told this website called The Pop Break that he had no idea who Iggy Pop was until his dad showed him the Funhouse album, which is one of the greatest rock and roll records ever made, but not exactly preteen boy listening. Just ends with L.A. Blues, which is like a horrifying free jazz saxophone wailing, Iggy wailing workout. As a sixth or seventh grader, I was just so psyched and completely immersed myself in all of his records. When Iggy came onto the set, I was like, I know everything you've ever done. And he was like, who's this 11-year-old kid talking about TVI and loving the record Funhouse? What the hell? This is so weird. And their friendship only grew from there. As we mentioned earlier, the episode A Hard Day's Pete concerned Pete forming a band to try and recreate a song that he heard a different garage band playing earlier.
Oh, yeah.
He said, Iggy saw that I was playing bass and that I really fell in love with the bass. He would ask me about it and say, oh, man, that is cool. Just being curious, I was like, hey, I'll bring my guitar in and we can jam. He said, that would be fun. He and I used to hang out at lunchtime if he was on set. We would have lunch together and chat about everything. He was such a cool dude, and he really treated me like an adult. He had no problem hanging out with a 12-year-old kid on set and telling me how he worked at a pet store, and that's how he got his name Iggy. And all sorts of other stuff, like living in the Lower East Side and really gritty, getting that gritty New York City vibe out of him. Do we think he told him about shooting up heroin? Or just was kind of obliquely like, kid, I've done a lot.
Wasn't there that story about him like getting stranded in Detroit in a tutu?
There's a couple of stories about him where like getting arrested in women's clothing. I think one of my favorites is their manager came in to bail him out and he saw that he was in a cell and wearing a dress. And he was like, just very exasperatedly when he, you know, bailed him out and was like, Iggy, why are you wearing a woman's dress? And Iggy goes, I beg your pardon. This is a man's dress. Like collects himself and walks past him.
I thought he got his name Iggy because he had a band in high school called the Iguanas, which were like a Beatles.
Yeah, that's another version that I've heard too. I don't know. You know, all many things. Two things can be true at the same time. I learned that in therapy.
Iggy lives in all of us.
Yeah, I do love him so much, man. He's such a sweet guy, except for all of the horrific stuff he did. When he was a f***ing waste of a human being.
Did you ever interview him?
No, I didn't. I would actually be a little intimidated by that. Like him and Nick Cave would be kind of like the ones I would be like a little bit like cowed by. Mostly because Nick Cave is so sad now.
Yeah.
Iggy, I mean, the funniest thing about Iggy, I think Henry Rollins said, where he's like, he's doing his long stand-up bit, and he's like, you know, the thing with Iggy is that there's two guys there. You know, there's Jim Osterberg, who's just a nice guy from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Like, oh, hey, yeah, how are you, man? Nice to meet you. We're going to have a good gig together. And then there's Iggy Pop, who's this snarling feral being of rock and roll incarnate, who's just like...
I love that you just did that. And this is such a great way of illustrating our differences. I love that you just made those noises and it was so effortless. I watched you do it. I don't know how to contort my mouth to get those sounds out of me. I don't, like, if I wanted to, which I don't, I made
a lot of monster noises as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
Budding
Foley artist.
Yeah, exactly. No, really, seriously. I also implore everyone to look up that early 90s Rollins routine, stand-up bit about his years-long rivalry with Iggy Pop. Seemingly one-sided, because he just had it in his head that he was going to blow Iggy Pop off stage, and over the course of like three concerts with Rollins' band, realized that would never happen and was impossible.
What a fool. He really thought that he could blow Iggy Pop out of the water?
Yeah, it was just like his personal thing that he had set in his mind, and his weird Henry Rollins way of being like, I must dedicate myself to this. And he tells it very funnily, and then he has this whole like, you know, he tells this whole story about how like the third time there's going to be this big, you know, they're going to go harder than they've ever gone before. And he's like singing his ass off. He's going to die on stage. And like, you finish it up. And like, then Iggy goes out with the Stooges and just like trashes the stage and like invites the crowd and the whole thing has to be like cleared off before the Cure can come on to close the festival. And then he's like, yeah. And, you know, I'm sitting backstage watching this with my jaw on the floor, and Iggy just walks past me and just goes,
that's right. I remember you telling me that story. I wonder if it ever crossed his mind to trash the Pete and Pete set. Like, if some kind
I think
of
they blow up an
amp.
They blow up an amp in that episode, right?
Oh yeah.
There's a thing where they something happens in the Hard Day's Pete episode.
I love stories of rock and roll legends giving these moments to kids, especially when the kids grow up, and that's so great. I'm trying to think of others offhand.
Well, you know, actually, Green Day, I always love that Green Day would end their concerts by, you know, asking people to come up and show them a quick and dirty version of an Operation Ivy song, which was the band that Tim Armstrong, like the guys from Rancid were in before they formed Rancid, and Rancid and Green Day are very close. And so the Green Day's whole act was to come up on stage and teach kids this song and then immediately have them play it on stage. And then they gave all the, they gave the guitars to the kids. I was like, Whoa. That's pretty transformational, you know?
Yeah. Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl's got a bunch of those too.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about Dave Grohl? I could see you not liking him because he's the Tom Hanks of rock.
Dude gets a pass because he played drums on that Queens of the Stone Age album, which is one of the best rock and roll albums of the 21st century. This or any other century. So
can I go with that and not, never mind?
Yeah.
Really?
It's more impressive drumming.
But Josh Homme is a...
Yeah, Josh Homme and Nick Oliveri are objectively garbage people, but man, that Songs for the Deaf is like, that's like a top 10 album for me, and like also 75% of the people I've known in music. That album smokes. It's a perfect record.
You know, he was tight with Bourdain. I was just watching the Roadrunner Bourdain documentary the other night, and Josh Homme and Bourdain were tight.
Ugh, that would make me sad.
For which one of them?
I mean, they probably just did a lot of drugs together.
He might have done the theme to Parts Unknown, now that I think about it.
Parts Unknown.
Anyway, back to Pete and Pete. Other prominent guests came from all over. Steve Buscemi was then doing weird performance art as a duo with Mark Boone, who you mentioned earlier of Sons of Anarchy fame in the New York City downtown scene of the late 80s, played the father of Big Pete's friend, Ellen. That's right. I forgot that he was Ellen's dad. Comic Janine Garofalo was a teacher at their school. And Larissa Olenek crossed over from another Nickelodeon hit, The Secret World of Alex Mack, to play a nurse, while Adam West was Little Pete's school principal long before Family Guy thought to get him. I forgot. These are all like dimly ringing a bell. Wow, I forgot about that. J.K. Simmons, Ellen Cleghorn, Selma Blair, Chris Elliott. The list of character actors showing up for brief roles on Pete and Pete goes on and on. Garofalo told Vulture, I was here in New York doing SNL, and Pete and Pete was something you would notice if you were flipping through the channels. It's not like it was a buzz about town, but obviously it was something like, hey, did you see that show?
Will McRobb has consistently said that Nickelodeon was fairly hands-off when it came to Pete and Pete, and more or less let his group do their own thing. He told Vulture, nobody had ever told us how to make a one-minute short film or how to make a half-hour special or series. We just did what felt right. We didn't know anything about the rules of screenwriting and TV writing and how to get to commercial break and anything like that. But the sad part, of course, is once you do it a number of times, you start to understand the rules of the game, you know? You have that liberation a couple of times, then you find yourself fighting your instincts to make it a standard show. It was pretty wild to go through that experience in a very hands-on way.
But as the network evolved, that strategy changed, and Pete ultimately came to an end after its third season. The team didn't necessarily know they were making their last episode, but treated it as something of a trial for a slight change in format if the show did return, which obviously it never did. Both Viscardi and McRobb admitted that after working on the show from 1989 to 1995, they were feeling the effects of burnout and started thinking of moving on. But Viscardi admitted to the AV Club, of course, when we had that fateful meeting with the Nickelodeon executives and they told us they weren't bringing it back, it was pretty heartbreaking.
He went on to talk about the approach to their last show, Saturday, which brings together disparate plots from what five different characters are doing on a Saturday in Wellsville, was something very different. I don't know if it ever would have worked to do a whole season like that. He does have a fondness for the last show of the episode, though. When that episode was over and all the kids were together, they just go outside and they help driver Stu push the back of the bus, and the camera pulled back. It just said so much about what the series was about. That sense of friendship in suburbia with a bunch of strange characters. Big Pete had his hair lopped off, and Ellen was wearing a beaten-up bunny suit, and they're eating pizza. Kid had sneakers on that he didn't want to get spotty, and a girl was dressed as a ninja. There was just so much weirdness in that shot. It was cold. It was wintertime. It definitely felt like a fitting end. If it was going to be the end, and it turned out that it was. McRobb chimed in, if we had known that that was the last episode and we tried to write a goodbye episode, I don't think it would have been nearly as good as it was with us not knowing. We would have tried too hard to do more with the goodbye rather than just write a great episode. And Viscardi goes on to add some additional context to the tale of that interview. He said, that was the time when Nickelodeon started to make the shift into making more straight-down-the-middle mainstream programs. Ren and Stimpy was gone. It was the beginning of the Dan Schneider era. Nothing against Dan's shows.
But everything against him, because he's a pederast.
But they're differently more mainstream, right down the middle. Very funny in their own ways, but very, very different than what we were trying to do. You could kind of see the writing on the wall. That was the direction the network wanted to take their programming. Pete and Pete was always a struggle to keep on the air from the beginning, and once the network started making the shift into even more of a straight, crowd-pleasing show that needed to be for everyone, not just a group of passionate fans, it was going to be a lot harder for us to stay on the air.
Pete and Pete nearly got a second chance at life, though. Nickelodeon's 2000 film Snow Day was originally intended as a full-length Pete and Pete film scripted by McRobb and Viscardi. I guess it was presented to Nickelodeon Movies when that imprint launched in 1995. For Hollywood reasons, presumably, the Pete and Pete-ness of it all didn't materialize, and in the intervening time between when it actually was released in 2000, the original cast aged out of their roles, and it was made with... I actually don't know. In my mind, I Mandela affected it and thought that Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes were in this movie. I think I might be thinking of Big Fat Liar. I actually have no idea who's in this movie. not anyone from Pete and Pete.
You know what I remember from this movie?
What's that?
Hoku?
No.
Who sang the theme song?
Mm-mm.
The single Another Dumb Blonde?
Nope.
She was Hawaiian? Let's see if this rings any bells.
Okay.
I also had a crush on her.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That it's time that I should just let you go. So I'll tell it to your face instead of tell it to you on the phone. You see, I thought that you were special, baby, something unique. But lately I've come to find that you're not really interested in my heart.
This song sucks. She's Don Ho's daughter. You know
what?
That?
Tiny Bubbles, Don Ho?
The king of the king of Hawaiian music, Don Ho. Nepo babied his daughter into that f***ing shitty song. No, Snow Day starred Chris Elliott, Gene Smart, yeah. Chevy Chase, Skylar Fisk, Pam Grier, Josh Peck, Emmanuel Shirikri. Quite a stacked cast, if you will. God, I hate that song. She's pretty, though.
Snow Day producer Albie Hecht says in Slimed, I fought to make Snow Day, which is essentially a Pete and Pete movie based on that whole idea of magic realism that Chris and Will do well. Will McRobb adds, if you look at that movie, you can see a Pete and Pete template. We had a lot more material that made Snow Day a lot more Pete and Pete, but eventually it got cut out. If it could have been more like the show, I would have been more proud of it.
Yeah, I tried to really dig deep into this and find out exactly what happened, but it eluded my grasp, and I couldn't find any in-depth interviews that either McRobb, Viscardi, or that producer made about it.
I'm guessing the Pete and Pete just aged out, and then it was like, well, what are we gonna do?
I mean, unfortunately, that kind of shit happens all the time, man. It just gets added to your slush pile, and then somebody has another idea or finds it and is just like, hey, well, we can do this now. And you're like, well, where were you back when?
Iggy Pop also had a bit part in this. Pam Grier, as you mentioned, that's so weird.
Very few stones to turn over at this point, other than my history of shoplifting. But a couple of great quotes that I wanted to leave you fine folks with. Mike Big Pete Marona told The Ringer, when I look back, I think the show is a polemic. It's an angry editorial about growing up and fighting against growing up and cherishing being a kid. Maybe little Pete's character is in the grief stage and mine is in the acceptance stage. Then Toby Huss, who played Artie, the strongest man in the world, says in Slimed, the most subversive thing about Pete and Pete will always be the people who all got together to make it. We're all a little like that. It's hard to explain, but it was a little shimmering time back then. I think that's beautiful. I hope more people rediscover this show.
Yeah.
Learning more about it made me feel much more indulgent and charitable toward it than I had previously, which is, you know, a great thing to feel towards art you maybe didn't get as much with when it was of its time. Final thought?
I'm still trying to perfect my arty voice. Well said.
Thank you for listening, everyone. This has been Too Much Information. I am Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtog. We'll catch you next time.
Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog.
The show's supervising producer is Michael Alder June.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtog and Alex Heigl,
with original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.